Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In a call that has alarmed election watchdogs across the country, President Trump repeated his false claims of ballot tampering in Georgia and urged the Secretary of State there to find enough votes to overturn his loss in November.
They are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard, and they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can, both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
Trump said that the alleged ballot tampering, if unchecked, will dampen enthusiasm among Republican voters in two runoff elections in Georgia that will determine control of the U.S. Senate. Political reporter Stephen Fowler has been covering all of this for Georgia Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I'm not sure, but I think it was you that did the public records request that brought this to light.
So it wasn't actually a public records request. It was a source that gave it to me who was pretty disgusted with. So I guess first off, you know, Georgia has a Republican Secretary of State and who's a big Trump supporter, gave money to him, voted for him. And so in the days after the election, there have been more and more attacks on our Secretary of State and on the integrity of the election and all of these things. And there have been more and more people who are fed up with that. And within this growing universe of people who are Republicans and support election integrity, there are a lot of people that want to know, that want others to know what the Secretary of State is dealing with. So Sunday morning, I was, I think, in the canned vegetable aisles of Kroger, and I got an hour-long audio link to this call with the president. And from there, it was off to the races. The Washington Post had it first, and then we had it on NPR after that. It took some time to verify some of the things in it. But yeah, I obtained that from a source who sent me the tape and said, everyone needs to know. And now everyone knows.
Everyone knows. How are Georgians responding to this?
Well, it depends very much. There are three camps. There are Democrats who obviously say this is more evidence that why we voted for Joe Biden, why President Trump needs to be out of office. Some have called for investigations from our attorney general or the local county district attorney or the state election board or, you know, whoever to investigate this. Then there are Republicans who fall under the camp of supporting the president that they say, you know what, actually, this call shows President Trump knows so much about fraud and, you know, he's so on top of things that this call shows that Georgia's Secretary of State is participating in a cover-up and it's his fault and he should be in trouble for leaking this call. And then there are some that are being a little bit more silent that say that it's really unbelievable to hear the president so openly pressure an election official to do that. But they're keeping quiet because we have the Senate runoff election today.
Now, just to be clear, there's nothing of the president's allegations of vote tampering that are founded in it and based in any kind sense of fact.
If you listen to the full call, which, you know, the Washington Post has put out, and you read the things that the Secretary of State and his lawyer kind of patiently went through and point by point said, no, this isn't true. These are all things that have been spreading on the internet in these fever swamps of misinformation for weeks and weeks, and they've been knocked down. You know, they've been forcefully knocked down in some cases. You know, there was an allegation that ballots were being scanned multiple times and a secret suitcase full of ballots came up in the middle of the night while everyone went home.
A suitcase
and,
or a trunk.
For weeks that's been debunked, but you have the president of the United States saying, oh, you know, I won by 250,000 votes when in reality he lost by 12,000 votes. And this has been investigated by the Republican Secretary of State. Law enforcement has got involved and investigated these claims. And Trump insulted the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and law enforcement saying they were incompetent. And so nothing that the president has pushed about Georgia's elections are true.
given those three camps you mentioned, you know, the president brought up the fact that unless the Secretary of State finds those votes, overturns the presidential election results in Georgia, it will depress Republican turnout at the polls in these two runoff elections. And I'm wondering, I mean, could also the president himself be depressing turnout at this point?
So there's two things. One, looking at early voting turnout, more than 3 million people cast a ballot before today, either early in person or through absentee by mail. Mm-hmm. And there's a drop off from the general election because even though there's, you know, almost $1 billion spent on these Senate races, you know, it's the holidays, people are tired of getting 10 mailers a day or what have you. The Republican parts of the state up in Northwest Georgia and Northeast Georgia were voting way less. So turnout is down there. The Metro Atlanta area, which is driving most of the turnout, is healthily up and it leans Democratic or is heavily Democratic in some areas. And then in Southwest Georgia, which is part of what's known as the Black Belt because it's a string of rural, predominantly Democratic, predominantly African-American counties, they're voting a lot. And so just looking at changes from November, you can see there are both more Democrats voting and fewer Republicans voting. And it's definitely the president has something to do with it. I mean, last night at his rally, that was ostensibly to get people to vote for two Senate candidates.
Right.
He spent most of his time talking about voter fraud in Georgia and voter fraud in New York and how he won the election and, you know, all these other sorts of things. He said they're not going to steal the White House when, in fact, in about 15 days, Joe Biden's going to take a big U-Haul in and bring his stuff and become the next president.
The double barrel runoff election. It's not supposed to work that way. Every state has two senators and they run for re-election in different years. But in this case, Kelly Loeffler was appointed to the job last year, and she had to run for election again, you know, to get the job back.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, since Johnny Isaacson retired and resigned, Loeffler was appointed to fill out the rest of his term, which the rest of his term is 2 years from now. But to do that, you have to win an election to fill out the rest of the term. And it just so happened to line up with this Senate election. And so Kelly Loeffler was one of 20 candidates on the ballot. Raphael Warnock was the other one. And so nobody was going to get above 50% there. And that's how you end up with these double barrel runoffs. And the interesting thing is the University of Virginia has a list of double barrel Senate runoffs in history. And most of the time, if one party wins one seat, they win the other. But this time, because Georgia is so tight and so close and so polarized, it is possible that you could see a Democrat win one seat and a Republican hold on to the other.
Where do you see that happening, or why do you see that happening, given the fact that the same number of people are turning out at the polls for both races?
So David Perdue and John Ossoff are very known entities. Ossoff ran, at the time, the most expensive U.S. House race ever in 2017. He lost narrowly, but he has raised a bunch of money. People know who he is, and he is clearly defined as a candidate. Same with David Perdue, who is a, you know, first-term senator who's been there for several years. They know who he is. Loeffler and Warnock are two political novices. You know, a year ago this time, people barely knew who Loeffler was. She was like 1 week into being a senator, and Warnock was still just the pastor of an Ebenezer Baptist church where some people knew him locally, but he hadn't thrown his hat into the ring. And so that race is a lot more volatile in regards of identity and who people are dealing with. And so Warnock has spent most of his time in the special election building up his name recognition and creating a positive message. Loeffler had to survive a brutal, brutal intra-party fight with Doug Collins, the right-wing congressman from Northeast Georgia. And so she's got a lot more baggage on her and a lot more negatives than David Perdue. So it's possible that there are people who could vote for David Perdue and Raphael Warnock. And, you know, if the margin's going to be 20, 30,000 votes, there could be enough of those split ticket voters that could end up having a split decision.
I make the assumption that if you show up to the ballot and that you're going to vote in both elections. But that may not be the case, too, right?
Well, right.
There'll be some drop-off.
That too, because there's also a third race, which is a statewide public service commission, which is a utility regulator.
Oh, okay.
And so there is a Democrat and a Republican there. But, what we saw in Georgia, part of why Joe Biden won and narrowly flipped the state was you had a lot of people in Atlanta's northern suburbs that are moderate Republicans that did vote for David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler, but also voted for Joe Biden because Joe Biden, although he is a Democrat, is a lot more mild and a lot more predictable than President Trump. And so while President Trump is, challenging the election and going off and saying he won and things, there are Republicans that voted for Joe Biden that also said, we need a Republican Senate. So I'm going to vote for David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler because they also represent my ideals.
Where's the money come from for these races? They've demolished past spending records now, as you mentioned. It's coming in from all over the place, big and small.
The better question is, where isn't the money coming from? I mean, you've got John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock from October 15th to mid-December, each raised over $100 million in a two-month span. And the Republicans have raised a bunch of money. And I think together collectively from mid-October to mid-December, it was something more than $300-something million raised just in that period. You've got outside group spending. You've got groups that try to defend or take over the Senate majorities coming in. You've got so much money that, you can't see it because it's radio, but my 80-year-old grandfather has been keeping a log of all of the groups that call and text and send him things because they think he is a middle-aged black man. And so there's something wrong with the voting data there. But the groups that are sending mailers and calls and texts are local groups that are normally just small potatoes. We focus on these counties or we focus on this every so often. But people are just so flush with cash that you can't walk without getting hit with ads and mailers and things like that.
You know, we talk about Georgia voters being exhausted by all of this, but it sounds to me with a 3 million people already churning out and early voting, today's the last day of voting, that they're also energized.
Absolutely, because, Georgia, everyone says Georgia is the center of the political universe, but it feels more like a black hole, just sucking in everyone's time and energy and attention. I mean, Georgia is a state that for my entire life has been reliably Republican. Republican governor, Republican legislature, Republican statewide officials, for much that I can remember, and hasn't voted for a Republican president since before I was born. Being excited about that, Stacey Abrams has worked to turn out a wide coalition of Democratic voters that get people excited. But also, too, this is like fourth and one on triple overtime to win, the Super Bowl of Super Bowls. That, the direction of our country, most political ads are hyperbole, but the direction of our country and what Joe Biden gets to do in his first 2 years of his presidency comes down to who shows up before 7 p.m. today. Because if Ossoff and Warnock win, the Senate is 50-50, and Vice President Kamala Harris would be the tie-breaking vote. And if the Republicans win, not only do they still maintain control of the Senate, but there are still several Republican senators that have indicated that they are going to continue on Trump's legacy and Trump's pathway and just really be a big roadblock.
Just before I let you go, last month, two federal judges threw out a pair of Republican-backed lawsuits seeking to restrict Georgia's absentee voting rules. There is an effort afoot in the Republican-controlled Senate, correct me if I'm wrong, of course, to do something about that law in 2021. What's going on there? Do they think it played that big of a role, and is this a suppression effort?
Well, Republicans picked Georgia's new voting system. Republicans wrote most of Georgia's election laws. Republicans are the ones that used no excuse absentee voting, you know, up until 2020, when the pandemic just kind of sent everyone down this pathway. And there's no indication that Georgia is going to become a heavy vote by mail state once the pandemic gets under control. But there's just this reactionary politics where our Republican controlled legislature now wants to try to undo absentee by mail voting because they think there's fraud despite evidence to the contrary. And so, you know, when you have the president and when you have these top leaders making these baseless claims and getting it, you know, stuck in people's heads, there are real policy consequences to it. And that's something that, regardless of who wins today and who controls things nationally, you know, at the state level, that's where the next fight's going to be.
And then any chance that the races will be called tonight?
No, because there are nearly a million absentee ballots and it takes time to process them and count them and count all the early votes and count all the election day votes. And we have 159 counties with 159 election supervisors. You know, the earliest you could feasibly see something is Wednesday because the margin's also going to be so tight. So when there are still a couple hundred thousand absentee ballots to count, you know, you have no idea if it's going to be, you know, 100,000 all for one candidate, or if it's going to be 50-50 split and it's going to come down to every vote. But right, we should know, you know, Wednesday or Thursday.
And then just to be clear for listeners, they do it, I think, in Georgia, correct me if I'm wrong, but they wait until all the votes are in to start processing them. Whereas in Ohio, they start processing them, but they don't count them until the polls close.
So Georgia's the same way.
Okay.
Counties this time, because it took so long to count and there was so much drama, counties had to start processing them last Monday so that they didn't have a big backlog. But obviously, you can return your absentee ballot as long as it's received by 7 p.m. So even if they work through those backlogs, there's still going to be ballots that have to be processed and counted. And so they could do everything but hit tabulate before the polls close.
Okay.
And that's how we'll know.
Well, Stephen Fowler, good luck over the next 48 to 72 hours hanging in there. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Stephen Fowler is political reporter for Georgia Public Broadcasting. We will continue our conversation about what's happening in Georgia today as voting ends at 7 p.m. tonight, as Stephen said. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Today is the last day of voting in two U.S. Senate runoff races in Georgia. The outcomes will determine control of the U.S. Senate. Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler, who was appointed to the job last year, and Democrat Reverend Raphael Warnock squared off in a nationally televised debate in November, trading barbs over everything from abortion to pandemic relief.
You know, during this pandemic, we call people essential workers. We ought to pay them an essential wage. And we ought to provide small business owners like her the assistance and the support that they need. Kelly Loeffler's out of touch.
Look, these are more lies from radical liberal Raphael Warnock, someone that has invited Fidel Castro, a murderous dictator, into his own church, someone that has celebrated anti-American, anti-Semite Jeremiah Wright.
We're talking about the runoff races and how Georgia has shifted purple after two decades of Republican control. Kyle Condick is managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. It's a nonpartisan newsletter on American campaigns and elections published by the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Welcome back, Kyle.
Good morning.
And University of Georgia political scientist Charles Bullock has authored, co-authored, edited, or co-edited more than 30 books and more than 250 articles on Southern politics, legislative politics, and elections. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Good to be there.
Charles Bullock, runoffs are historically low turnout affairs. That doesn't appear to be holding true this time around, right?
That's right. Yeah, we've had over 3 million ballots cast, and you don't have to go very far back in history to see when we wouldn't get 3 million votes cast in a regular gubernatorial election. So with the voting today and then absentee ballots, which are still being received, we could hit 4 million. Well, until we hit 5 million back in November, the largest turnout we'd ever had was in 2018, and that was 4.1 million. So yes, there'll be some drop off between November and today, but there's still an awful lot of Georgians who are expressing their preferences.
What do you attribute the drop off to? Just, you know, garden variety exhaustion or something more? Because we've been talking previously about the impact of President Trump disputing the election results from November, and also the general polarization.
Yeah, well, to put this in a bit of a context, usually between a general election and a general election runoff, drop off may be 40-50%. In some instances, it's been as much as 90%. So even if we saw a 20% drop off this year, that would be the best evidence of people coming back to vote. Now, why don't we have the same level of participation in this runoff as we had in November? Well, in part because the presidency is not at stake. And for a lot of American voters, not just Georgia voters, the only thing that gets them to the polls is when they're going to go vote for or against someone for president. So removing that, that's going to result in some of the drop off.
But it does, it is putting at stake what this presidency is going to be able to achieve, Kyle Condit, depending on who controls the Senate.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Democrats have to win not just one, but both of these Senate races to forge a 50-50 tie that Vice President-elect Kamala Harris would break. And, you know, it is significant. I mean, I do still think that, you know, even if the Democrats were to win both races, there would still be some constraints on their power. Obviously, there's the Senate filibuster still exists. Mm-hmm. And not every single Democrat in the Senate, you know, particularly someone like Joe Manchin, the West Virginia Democrat, is going to be on board with all of Joe Biden's most ambitious policy proposals, but it would give Joe Biden room, at least for his first 2 years, assuming nothing changed in the Senate, no one, you know, resigned or died or whatnot. It would give Biden more room not only to pursue some of his policy objectives, but also just to get his cabinet officials through, to get judicial appointments through, because otherwise, if Mitch McConnell's still the Senate Majority Leader, there may be, you know, McConnell may try to gum up the works in a lot of different ways. So, you know, the stakes obviously are very high for Joe Biden's presidency.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about those Georgia U.S. Senate runoff races. My guest, you just heard Kyle Condit. He's managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. It's a newsletter from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And also with us, political scientist Charles Bullock from the University of Georgia. If you have a question or comment about these Georgia runoff races, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. How does race figure into and affect runoff elections in Georgia, Charles Bullock?
Yeah, well, in the past, African-American voters have been more reluctant to return for the second election than have white voters. This may be changing this year, and indeed in early voting, we saw that African-Americans were punching above their weight. Now, by that, I mean that while about 30% of the registered voters in Georgia are African-American, they cast almost 31% of the votes. And that was particularly noteworthy because back in November in the early voting, African-Americans' share of that was about 28%. So this indicates that the Black vote is very much mobilized. And that is absolutely essential for Democrats to have any hope of success because, you know, in Georgia, as in much of the nation, the Black vote's going to go 80 to 90% for the Democrats. And with an African-American candidate here, and Reverend Warnock, that may partially explain why we've seen this higher incidence of Blacks returning to the polls. And he may do extraordinarily well among that component of the electorate.
And what do we know about habits when it comes to, is it, if you're going to submit a ballot by mail or an early ballot or go to the polls at all, are you going to vote in both races necessarily? And I know there's a third utility commissioner race on the ballot as well.
My expectation is that most people, if they're going to go vote, they will probably vote for all three. I think a lot of people will be surprised when they see that public service commission contest because it is not something which candidates go out and spend a lot of money on. I mean, here we've had, the estimates are $800 million spent on the Senate races.
Right.
you know, maybe 80,000 spent on the PSC contest. So I think, again, most people will go there and probably vote Republican, 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 or Democrat, Democrat, Democrat. I mean, it's possible some people may split their votes, but I wouldn't think that's going to be very common.
And Kyle Condit, there's been a lot of talk about the impact of the role of Stacey Abrams, gubernatorial candidate in the last round, narrowly lost. She, because of her narrow loss, saw the possibilities and the potential, and has been given a lot of credit for getting out the vote and marshaling that Democratic vote, particularly among African Americans in Georgia. What does that tell you about potential for Georgia and other states?
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, we just went through a couple election cycles, 2018 and 2020, mm-hmm. that were defined by really high turnout in states like Georgia, but also a lot of other states across the country. Now, I do think that between Abrams and other Democratic efforts that they have tried to activate more of the electorate there. But I also think you're seeing that there are a lot of people moving into Georgia who, you know, maybe sort of bringing some of their Democratic voting patterns with them, particularly if you look at places like Metro Atlanta, which I think has really driven the Democratic growth in the state, and Democratic performance in the Atlanta suburbs is a big reason why Joe Biden narrowly was able to win the state. You know, I was just reading this morning about there's a small but significant Hispanic population in Georgia, and there are lots of Democratic efforts to mobilize those voters. You know, these are, I believe, the most expensive Senate races we've ever had, and so there's a ton of money going on into not only into television but also into voter mobilization efforts on both sides. It seems like the Democrats have a lead going into Election Day, and then it's sort of now we're seeing whether the Republicans can turn out enough of their base today to win the election. And, you know, there's always been this kind of conventional wisdom that, oh, well, high turnout benefits Democrats. And that's sometimes true, but it's sometimes not. Here, I think we have an election where the larger the turnout is overall, you know, if we get over 4 million votes or even more than that, probably the more people who vote today, the better it is actually for Republicans, because so many of their voters seem to have waited until Election Day to participate.
Charles Bullock, do you agree?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I think if we stop the election today and simply counted the ballots which have been received, Democrats win. Again, this higher proportion of Blacks and other minorities in participating in the early election. The share of the early votes cast by whites is down to 55%. If that were to hold, and it won't, but were it to hold through today, probably no chance that Republicans can win. So yeah, the Republicans in part are still responding to Trump's criticisms about reliability of early voting, about, you know, sending in your vote, about doing the going and drop it off at a drop box. And so that has retarded Republican vote. And if we look, say, by congressional districts, the district where Donald Trump was last night, which is the 14th district, it and the adjoining 11th district, very red, very Republican districts, they've had the lowest participation. While you look there in Metro Atlanta, where the Democrats control those districts, and those have been the ones where you've had the highest turnout.
Let's see, Mike in Michigan, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Yes, and I was just thinking that, in my opinion, I really would be concerned to see if the Democrats could win the Senate. But the situation is at this point, I believe that Biden being a good negotiator, and the Democrats and the Republicans are going to be wanting certain things. If the Republicans don't give in to what the Democrats want, and if the Democrats don't give in to what the Republicans want, Biden can veto. And so that strong veto could be a big point in getting things done, because I'm sure there's going to be a lot of things that the Republicans want, and there's a lot of things that the Democrats want. And if so, it gets to a stalemate, no one's going to be satisfied, if you understand what I mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the question is, can a Biden still govern with a split Congress such as it is? Any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I mean, if we do in fact have a Democratic House, which the Democrats narrowly have the majority now, And if the Republicans hang on to the Senate in these runoffs today, there may not be a whole lot that gets to Joe Biden's desk to have the opportunity to veto, because in order to pass legislation, you're going to have to the Democratic-controlled House and the Republican-controlled Senate.
Got to cover both houses,
things. And there are some things that are kind of must-pass legislation. You know, the debt ceiling and budgets and those sorts of things. But in terms of big picture legislation. Again, there might not be much for Biden to veto, because there might just not be much to reach his desk. And if the Democrats do have control, then presumably Biden and Senate Democrats and House Democrats will be working in concert to pass whatever it is they decide they want to pass.
Charles Bullock, you've labeled Biden's win in Georgia as historic, saying that Bill Clinton's and Jimmy Carter's victories deserve asterisks. So we think of going back to Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton saying he's not the first Democrat, but you go back farther as far as the relevance.
Yeah. A point I was making is that this is the first time that Georgia has voted for a Northern Democrat since Jack Kennedy.
Yeah.
And so, is Georgia going to vote for a hometown candidate like Jimmy Carter? Yeah. And indeed, in 1980, Georgia was the only Southern state that stuck again with its hometown candidate. And then in 1992, yes, Georgia showed up behind Bill Clinton, but that was only because you had Ross Perot there, who siphoned off about 17% of the vote. And my expectation is that virtually all of those were Republican votes. And had it just been a head-to-head against Bush and Clinton, Bush would have carried Georgia. So, Georgia for a century voted always for Democrats, and these were, with rare exception, always Northern Democrats. But in the last 60 years, if there's been a Northern Democratic nominated, Georgia has not gotten behind that person.
We are talking about the Georgia runoff races for the U.S. Senate. That is Charles Bullock. He is a political scientist at the University of Georgia. And also with us is Kyle Kondik, managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball, a newsletter from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the two high-stakes Senate runoff races in Georgia. Voting there ends today. The outcome will determine who controls the U.S. Senate. Still with us, Kyle Kondik, managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. That's a newsletter, a nonpartisan newsletter from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And Charles Bullock, a political scientist at the University of Georgia. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Charles Bullock, you've said that Georgia will be a battleground state through the 2020s because of the changes that you were talking about earlier. Do you see other southern states headed in that direction for the same reasons?
Yeah, I divide the South now into the growth South and the stagnant South. Mm-hmm. And the growth South is pretty much along the East Coast, and then I would also add in Texas. Virginia's already become a blue state. It's no longer really a toss-up anymore. Georgia, North Carolina, Florida are showing signs of supporting Democrats. Texas, there were a lot of expectations that there might be some Democratic gains there. There were not this year, but again, its population is changing with people moving in, with the cities growing, and then sooner or later, that huge Hispanic vote is going to become very mobilized. So of those states along the Eastern Shore, kind of South Carolina is a bit of a laggard, but these states are ones in which Democrats are making gains, where in comparison, if you look at places like Alabama and Arkansas, Republicans are still making gains in those states, where in the rest of the growth states, the Republican strength has peaked and is now in decline. So yeah, I think that coming into presidential elections 2024, 2028, we may be talking much more about the southern states than we will about Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania.
And, of course, Ohio has already gone the way of it's considered pretty solidly red now. But, right. I mean, a lot of that has to do, Kyle Kondik, with you know, gerrymandering and how the districts are drawn in Ohio as far as our representation in Congress. But be that as it may, Donald Trump won by a solid 8 percentage points again in Ohio. So it feels like the shift is, it's not just happening in the South. It's kind of a physics thing at this point. It's happening everywhere.
Yeah, there's been this demographic trade-off that was happening before Donald Trump, but I think Trump sort of kind of hypercharged the trend. And it's basically that the Republicans have been picking up more and more support amongst white voters who don't have a four-year college degree, kind of white working class voters, although a lot of white voters without a four-year degree do quite well economically. So it's not necessarily a rich versus poor sort of thing. But then also that a lot of white voters with a four-year college degree, a lot of people who live in affluent suburban areas, they've been trending more toward the Democrats after they used to be a reliable Republican bloc. And, you know, you could see it in like suburban Columbus, for instance, that a lot of typically Republican places have been moving toward the Democrats. But across the rest of the state, a lot of places that where Democrats used to get support, particularly like the Mahoning Valley and Appalachian Ohio, have become much more Republican. You know, that trade-off has worked out poorly for Democrats in Ohio, but it's worked out really well in Virginia, as Professor Bullock mentioned. That's now a kind of a Democratic state because it's both diverse and highly educated, has these growing white collar suburban areas. And then we also saw that in Georgia in 2020, in that, you know, Metro Atlanta and affluent, highly educated suburban areas that are also pretty diverse around Atlanta. Those places helped power Joe Biden's victory. And so there's this kind of ongoing realignment going on in American politics in which you see states like Iowa and Ohio kind of moving off the competitive map, and a state like Georgia moving more clearly onto the competitive map.
You know, Ohio is a traditionally or historically a tough state to run in. There's something like 6 or 7 major media markets. It's expensive because of that. What about Georgia? Is Georgia a particularly, it's a vast state, it's big, but is it particularly hard to run in? I'm trying to think if there's a lot of media markets that you have to compete in.
Well, there are multiple media markets, but the Atlanta media market covers the vast majority of Georgia voters. Okay. And even areas a bit further out from Atlanta, they get their television out of Atlanta. Now, the Atlanta newspapers, no, they don't do much coverage. But the other media markets would be down in Savannah, which you cover along the coast. But we also get media coming in from out of the state, from Jacksonville, from Chattanooga. And when you're trying to spend $800 million, you go out and you start buying time in Jacksonville, you buy time in Tallahassee, you buy time in Chattanooga, you buy time in Greenville, South Carolina. So you're getting a number of other areas which get involved in this, but you can run, you know, and most candidates are going to spend most of their money in that Atlanta media market.
You know, this shift in Georgia, Kyle and Charles, could it have happened without the likes of a Stacey Abrams leading the charge since 2018, Kyle?
I think it could have happened, without her, although I do think that she has been an important figure in Georgia's political transformation. But I think it's important to note that similar kinds of places across the country have been changing in similar sorts of ways. So the same sorts of trends you see in Northern Virginia, you also see in Metro Atlanta, you also see in Metro Phoenix, Metro suburban Denver, Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, et cetera. So it's not like Georgia is necessarily a big outlier demographically. Now, I will say that I think having, in a state where you've got a very significant Black electorate and having really strong Black candidates, be it Abrams or Raphael Warnock running in the Senate runoff, there is some political science research that indicates that, you know, having a strong Black candidate on the ticket can help drive Black turnout a little bit. So Abrams and now Warnock may be important in that regard.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Charles Bullock.
Abrams has been very much of a catalyst. The changes, demographic changes, were underway. What she has done is to, through her organizations, go out and make the kinds of contacts, the grassroots contacts, to get folks who either rarely voted or they're not even registered at all. And this with both minorities, but also younger voters, have been what she has concentrated on. And then it's also helped And that a few years back, we changed what happens when you get or renew a driver's license. Now, it used to be you had to opt in, check a box. Yeah, I want to register. Now it's an opt-out situation. So a new person who moves to Georgia and gets a driver's license, they're immediately registered unless they say, no, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. So that has also helped pump up the growth we have in our registration.
Yeah, Kyle, talk about the youth vote a little bit. I'm kind of interested in how that played out in the presidential election this year and in places like Georgia.
Well, you know, the youth vote is always going to be it's kind of a group that punches under their weight in terms of turnout. And I will say that one of the things in the early vote is that there are some really positive signs for Democrats, particularly as Professor Bullock mentioned, the increasing share of the Black vote. Although it also seemed like the early vote kind of skewed a little bit older. But then again, that doesn't, you know, typically you might think that might be more Republican, but you know, that there are all sorts of different factors at play here. But, you know, the Republicans are going to win the day of election vote, but I'm sure Democrats are hoping that a big chunk of their voters show up too. And, you know, young people are always kind of a big variable with these elections because they're, you know, their turnout rates are just not as good as older cohorts are.
I watched the debate that was televised between Kelly Loeffler and Raphael Warnock, and I was trying to suss out Georgia-specific issues, and it was hard. I mean, it was really easy to listen to the debate from being an out-of-stater because it seemed like it could have been the same stuff they were talking about in Ohio. So, Charles Bullock, what about that? I mean, are there issues out there that Georgians are particularly interested in that maybe are falling under the radar for the rest of us?
Yeah, you're right about what you're hearing if you're listening to the debate. And indeed, what the Republicans have done is they've run a fear campaign. There's this ad that David Perdue, which has run time and time again, and it goes through and lists, you know, if the Democrats win, then you're going to lose your private health care. The police are going to be defunded. Military is going to be defunded. Immigrants are going to vote. Illegals are going to vote. All of those things. So, particularly on the Republican side, you hear very little, indeed almost nothing, about what they would do if they're elected. So it's pretty much that if you like the way things are now and you don't want to see any change, you want to vote Republican would be that message. On the Democratic side, there is some mention of issues. Again, it's not primarily issue driven. You know, certainly there's talk about criminal justice reform and a new Voting Rights Act. So again, an appeal to this critical share of the electorate, the African-American vote. Ossoff, because his wife is a doctor, also talks about wanting to improve the way in which healthcare is provided and also more specifically, the distribution of vaccines currently. And he talks also a bit about the environment. But yeah, it is not primarily an issue-driven campaign.
And so looking forward, Kyle Condit, as far as issues go nationally, do you see it becoming more non-issues? In other words, for lack of a better phrase, identity politics versus topics and issues in public policy?
I think that is kind of how our politics are now. And you know, I think particularly for Republicans in the South, you know, there was this long period where Republicans in 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, they were doing perfectly fine in the South in presidential elections, but they weren't winning as many Senate and House races as maybe they could or should have, or weren't winning state level races either. And so part of the strategy was to try to, you know, nationalize those races. And they eventually were able to do that. One of the architects of that strategy is the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, whose district was in the Atlanta area. And so I think what the sort of nationalized messaging in this race, particularly on the Republican side, is something that we're very much familiar with, both from Southern history, but also in a lot of races where Republicans are running in states and districts that they think generically favor them. They will just try to nationalize their races. Now, the big question is, have we reached the point where Georgia actually is not favorable turf to Republicans anymore? You know, is it a state where Republicans are trying to nationalize and that might not actually work? And this race will be an interesting data point in that regard. Well, I think it is worth noting that even though Biden won the state, You know, David Perdue finished a couple points ahead of John Ossoff in the voting in the first round of this race. The combined Republican vote in the Senate special election was a point higher than the combined Democratic vote. So there were still a small but important number of voters who were sort of splitting their tickets or maybe weren't voting straight Democratic down the ballot. So if the Republicans end up holding on, it might be because this small number of voters is actually, you know, is preferring divided government.
Hmm. Charles Bullock, what do you think?
Yeah, Kyle's absolutely right. Yeah, Donald Trump was the weakest part of the Republican ticket. That had he done as well as David Perdue or either the two Public Service Commission candidates, he would have won. But he ran behind everybody. So I think really what was happening was there's some share of the Republican electorate just couldn't bring themselves to vote for Donald Trump. Probably voted for him in 2016, but couldn't do it now. And it's probably the white, well-educated suburbanite, both male and female, because the exit polls show there's a huge increase in the share of the white college-educated male vote that went for the Democrat. It went from 21% for Hillary Clinton to 40% for Joe Biden.
Wow.
So I think what happened is these voters, they went in, they voted Biden, but then they got back in line and kind of corrected for their apostasy and voted Republican all the rest of the way down the ticket.
Let's see. Victor in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Victor.
Hello.
Go ahead.
How are you?
I'm fine.
Yes, I guess I have a comment or an opinion from, especially from the gentleman from Georgia. I lived in Atlanta back in the early 2000s, and I was a member of the Republican Party. I've been a member of the Republican Party for a while, and I just noticed over the last 20 years, especially in Georgia, that we have the Republican Party has continued to push minorities like myself out by spreading this propaganda, as I would say, of just that minorities or illegals are detrimental to the party in America. I just want to know what they think about that.
Charles Bullock. Thanks, Victor.
What the Republican Party is going to have to do if it wants to remain the dominant party, even competitive, is it's going to have to start broadening its base and broadening its message. I mean, it is a party which relies almost exclusively upon white votes. And when whites were casting, say, more than 75% of the votes in Georgia, as they were 25 years ago, sure, that strategy worked well. In 2018, the white vote was down a little bit below 59%. It's probably that level or maybe a little bit lower now. And so Republicans are going to have to start reaching out either to African Americans or the growing Hispanic or growing Asian populations, or the trends are that Democrats are going to come to dominate.
You know, Kyle Condit, just briefly on that point, and then also I want to know what the crystal ball's telling you.
And I think we saw this with Trump, in that there were a small but significant number of Republican voters who just thought Trump has gone too far on certain racially charged comments and those sorts of things. And some of those folks have been pushed out of the party. But again, there's been a push pull where Trump has also been a better Republican candidate particularly for white voters in rural areas. So again, there's a trade-off going on that's, it's helped Trump in some places, particularly in the Midwest, and it's hurt him, I think, in some places in the Sun Belt, particularly Georgia. We did our final crystal ball update for these races this morning. We still have them as toss-ups, so we don't really see a clear favorite. And just to reiterate what we were talking about earlier, it really just comes down to how big is the election day vote. Because again, if you just counted the early votes, 3 million votes, the Democrats are likely winning that block of votes by a relatively significant amount. In November, 80% of all the votes were cast before election day, and Joe Biden won those votes by about 6 points. But then Trump won election day by 23 points, and that almost allowed him to win the state. But there's a lot of disagreement and uncertainty about how big the election day vote is going to be. And that's why I say that the bigger the turnout is today, the likelier it is that the Republicans hold these seats.
Kyle Condit, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kyle Condit is managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. It's a nonpartisan newsletter from the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And Charles Bullock, political scientist from the University of Georgia. Thanks as well for your time. I really appreciate it.
Enjoyed being with you. Thank you.
And that's it. Thanks, everybody else, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.